need to be away from camera.
Stop it. What are you doing? You're camera shy.
So today's talk is about how do we know if God exists, and will be delivered by Brother Abdullah Al-Andalusi, inshallah. Now, Brother Abdullah is actually a revert to Islam. He was formerly a Christian before he converted to Islam at the age of 14, having studied the religion since the age of 10. He's an international speaker, thinker, and intellectual activist for Islam. His work involves explaining and demonstrating the proof for the Islamic belief system, as well as promoting the Islamic way of life and Islamic solutions for contemporary problems. He's appeared on a number of TV channels such as the BBC, ITV, and Al Jazeera, and in 2009, he co-founded the public discussion forum called the Muslim Debate Initiative. So without further ado, Brother Abdullah.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. As-salatu as-salam Nabi Kareem Muhammad. Al-Ali Tayyibin wa Sahbi Salihin. I greet you all the Islamic rings of peace. As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I'd like to thank the Islamic Society of Saudi University for inviting me for this talk. I'd like to thank you for attending. And today we're going to just be answering a little question, which is how do you know God exists? And examining really a history of the arguments attempting to deny God. And why did I focus on that? Why not just talk about how do you know God exists? Why do we have to talk about a history of all the arguments created and concocted to deny God's existence? And the reason being is because humans are very inventive, creative little creatures. And despite the fact that there might be absolute, plain, and indisputable evidence, at least using our intellects, at the very least, it never stopped or deterred a good human being who wanted, or not such a good one, but a person who was very good at using their intellect, from creating confusing realities or realities to try to divert and distort from people from the obvious facts. And if you think, well, humans are surely not that irrational, it's something to deny something that would be more in plain sight, well, I just point you to Exhibit A, the flat earthers, who still believe and still maintain that the earth is flat, despite overwhelming evidence, pictorial evidence, and of course direct observable evidence that the world isn't, and it wouldn't make sense anyway. I mean, even if the world was flat, the law of gravity would dictate that as you get to the edge of the earth, it would be like you're going up a mountain. So the edge of the earth would be basically, you couldn't reach the edges because you'd be like a sheer fall. And of course, a whole bunch of other things, such as obviously what keeps the oceans in check. And I'm sure they have all very seemingly plausible arguments to the uninitiated and uneducated as to why the earth is flat. They'll say, oh no, the surrounding of the earth is ridged with mountains or rock to stop the water from going over the edge. That's fine, but of course it does not explain, obviously, gravity, and of course why we can have orbiting satellites and many other such things. If the world was flat, it would come to a very confused understanding of a very confused reality regarding gravity and how things work if the world was flat, but it never stops people from believing that. And there's many, many other things. Of course, there are people who believe that the royal family are just, was it alien space lizards? And, yeah, that's it, a conspiracy theory about this. So, and of course, people believe that those trails that planes leave traveling through cold air is chemtrails designed to deliver chemicals to affect human beings for some strange and nefarious purpose not yet properly explained. So basically, never underestimate the capacity for creativity to deny the obvious or to deny what is basically without any other option or possibility, and they'll still deny it because they don't like the conclusion, i.e. human desires trump human rationality, unfortunately, on many things. And I wouldn't just say on this issue, I would dare say there's probably 1,001 things minimum that each one of you would probably deny if pointed out by yourself, because your internal psychological defense mechanism kicks in, wants to prevent you from, I don't know, realizing that maybe you're not so good at mathematics even though you're studying physics and you wished you hadn't. Or perhaps you're not as attractive as you think you are. Or perhaps that other person in the room which you just happen to hate is actually more attractive than you, and people do like that person more. So those things, we have against those harsh realities, we have a defense mechanism called denial. which is there to cushion us from some of these harsh realities. And the idea that there's a God that exists, and the possibility of human accountability that comes with that, and the fact that, no, you're not in control of your life, and no, you're not a unlimited, omnipotential individual who's unique and is in control of all things. No, you're basically a creation, a created being. Whether you believe in God or not, you're a created being. You're the product of perhaps your genetics, your family teaching you and upbringing you in a certain way, the society you were born in, which is why most of you will conform in your clothing, and of course language being the first thing that people generally conform to, and of course tastes and values will mostly be all the same as each other, but you're all yet still unique apparently, and the clothes you buy, which are sold to you with adverts to say embrace your uniqueness, are those same clothes which are mass produced by the tens of thousands, the hundreds of thousands of which you all purchase, but yet you are unique for purchasing them, as the adverts would want you to believe, and as those very rich media moguls would certainly enjoy, because they get to afford a new yacht for their marinas. So this is basically the nature of denial, which is why I wanted to go through in this lecture a history of people attempting to deny God's existence by producing very creative arguments and every permutation possible. But first, let's discuss, does God exist? Well, what do we mean by God? You know, because there's a blackboard in front of me, I just feel the compulsion to just get some chalk and start scribbling on it, and then subjecting you to questions and tests. So, I'm going to produce two criteria, two definitions, which I think, in total, define what we mean by God. If you're a Muslim, you certainly do not believe that God resembles human beings. Many people try to deny God's existence by saying that God is an anthropomorphization of reality, or the origins of reality, that God is some kind of a human being, or looks like a human, or acts like a human in some way, shape, or form. And they like to pick the Greek philosopher Xenophanes' famous statement, which is, if animals had made gods or had gods, they would depict them as looking like themselves. So if a cow believed in a god, he'd make a cow to look like themselves. And some atheists use Xenophanes' quotation, this ancient Greek philosopher, without realizing that Xenophanes actually, all he was using that argument was to reject polytheism. He actually used this argument to believe that God is above all things. There's only one God, and this God transcends all things and is unlike creation, which is the Islamic concept. So the Greek philosopher Xenophanes, of whom his quote is used by atheists, himself believed in one God and was using that quote to refute the polytheism and people who believed in gods which come down as human beings or animals or monkeys or what have you. He was using that quote to show that if there is a God, it doesn't look like us at all whatsoever. It transcends all things. So, two basic criteria. For something to be God and not be created in of itself, and hence not be God in the first place, it must be, you could say, uncreated. Which, I would argue, is exactly the same as it also being infinite. I now realize I capitalized this and didn't capitalize that. Sorry. And the second attribute I would posit is that in the definition of God, that for God to be God and not some mindless process, it would have to have something called a will, perhaps, the ability to initiate actions. A basic will. You all think you have a will, of course you do, but you don't have a truly free will as much as I would say the concept of God is, because God can, I would argue that God has a will that can initiate actions without any prior cause, whereas you require a cause to give you actions, to initiate your actions, such as you have to feel hunger for you then to make a choice as to what you want to eat. Although, I don't want to get too into it though, but Benjamin Libet and the neuroscientists have basically described that you don't really make most of the things you call choices, they're usually most of its calculations. The only thing that you have a real choice in is when your desires contradict your intellect, and then you basically have a real choice between what do you pick. But I won't go into that. So that's a different discussion for a different day, perhaps. So anyway,
Two things. Uncreated infinite has a will. That's the definition of God. Doesn't need to look like a human being. Certainly, if it was a human being, it wouldn't, or looked like a human being, it wouldn't be infinite, because in the Latin, finite means finis, which means limited. Or if you're an Arabic speaker, you can say mahdud, right? From hudud, right? Means limitation. So infinite is ghair mahdud, meaning not limited in Arabic. And of course, it's the same in Latin as well. Of course, you can also use the Greek aperion if you wish. Also means the same, not limited. If I can scroll that, which is what the Greeks discussed. Aperion, without limitations. Anyway, so how do we know that such something exists that has both will and is infinite and unlimited and obviously uncreated? Well, people often use the argument saying, well, the universe began to exist. And of course, then some people will say, but how do we know the universe began to exist? How do you know this for certain? Well, I can deduce rationally that the universe had a start point without even needing to entertain what's called the Big Bang Theory, mainly by asking the simple question, which is, if this moment in time is, you consider it to be one point, let's say this is one moment in time, let's just visualize it as a circle, and it was preceded by a previous moment in time, or a previous moment in anything, time is just being a measure of change, and so on and so on and so forth. Now, if you believe that there was no start point, what you believe is that this moment in time, depending on this moment in time, depending on this moment in time, depending on such and such and such and such, ad infinitum, meaning going on forever. If that's the case, would we ever get to this point in time if we had to rely on an infinite eternity before us? I'll just give you an example. This lecture was unfortunately delayed. If you were told by the Islamic Society, they said, if they were to tell you, Abdullah's coming, be patient, he'll just be here in an infinite amount of time. Would I ever arrive? Anyone?
No.
Oh, the kid gets it. How come no one else gets it? He's like younger than you guys. Are you like students or something? Like, you're meant to be students at this university. How's the kid getting this? All right. You never arrive. And maybe I'll put it in another way. If I said, this lecture will go on for an infinite amount of time, then you can leave. Would you ever get to leave? No. So rationally, and as I said, it's not just me, even the ancient Greeks, and of course Plato and Aristotle and many others came to the same exact conclusion, which is that there has to be a start point. But of course, the question is, what started that start point, or what is this start point which started this whole process going? So what is the nature of this start point? And why do things need to be... be created? And now you can talk about causality, but I can just say the same thing about usually what I do in these lectures is I ask the Islamic Society orders to provide me with a rock. They can find it anywhere around, and they get kind of worried thinking, is he going to throw it at people and like ask him silly questions? Might do, but rather I actually use the rock to illustrate. I ask a simple question, which is, how do we know, if I was holding up a rock, how do you know that the rock is created? Now if I was to hold up a mobile phone or a watch, there's a clock in the back, and usually someone who's probably a fan of Richard Dawkins will say, that's the watchmaker argument. So I don't need to use a watchmaker argument, let's use the rock maker argument. What creates a naturally occurring, a rock you would just find outside. And people say, well, this was formed from geological processes, and I say, well, how do you know this? And they say, well, I've seen, you know, say lava coming out, spewing out of volcanoes, or pictures or videos of it anyway. And so I conclude that this rock was probably formed in the same way. And I was like, well, did you see that particular rock being formed, or any particular rock being formed? So they would know. Oh, but I could probably carbon date it. I said, yeah, but carbon dating depends if it has carbon in it, but also it just tells you the level of the decay occurring in the rock. It doesn't mean that you know for absolute certain when it was formed or created. And secondly, you never saw, when any rock, most rocks you think you see, you haven't seen them be created. Of course, I could take any object. I could just take this apple cart and say, how do you know it's created? And not something that was eternal, not an eternal apple juice carton. And of course people say, well, because it's got human language on it. And I say, okay, well maybe humans found it and printed human language on it. How do you know that this carton was created? Same process. And they'll say, well, I've seen maybe videos of this cartons like that be created. I'll say, okay, but have you seen that carton be created? Maybe all cartons are based on this as the eternal model carton. This is the pre-existent carton that existed before this universe was. And when this universe came to being, this carton floated through space, landed on Earth, humans found it, and quite surreptitiously used it as a model for all other cartons. And they lost it in their factory, in its shrine, and it came in and got distributed to you, and you're now drinking from it now, because it got put apple juice into it, of course. How do you know that this carton isn't eternal and uncreated carton? Does anyone have any argument why that they would know for certain that this carton wasn't an eternal carton that humans found, printed on it, put apple juice in it, but for all intents and purposes didn't have any affect us as to creating it in the first place? How do you know that this carton isn't eternal? Sorry?
Because you can end it.
Because you can end it. Yes, I suppose so, but that doesn't necessarily mean, how do you know it's just not a mortal, eternal carton? That it always existed, but you can just crush it. I usually get a rock as well to make people think extra hard, but sometimes I can actually pick any object. Doesn't anyone know that this carton isn't uncreated? I mean, I didn't think it was a hard question. I'm getting worried someone's going to say, I don't know, and start worshipping it. So, I hope not. Although I wouldn't put it past some people, perhaps, who knows, in this planet.
Well, we recognise that it has attributes or features which indicate it's been designed, yeah? Those would be one argument.
Well, it might have attributes similar to things that have been designed, but in itself might not have been designed.
Right.
How would you know?
I think you base it on probability. So, like, if majority of evidence suggests that it's been created, then you kind of go with that majority. It's like with everything in life. It's like.
So you're saying that you can't tell for certain whether this carbon isn't eternal, uncreated.
We know that it's not. Like,
how do we know?
That's what we don't. It's just, again, it's just we presume. It's like that majority percentage.
Okay, I'm going to see if I can make it easier. I'm going to try to see if I can make it easier. So say someone gets a statue, let's say a statue, a statue of some kind of fantasy creature, let's say a unicorn, perhaps, and says, oh, this is the statue of the creator of the universe, let's worship it, let's pray to it, and the statue is uncreated. Literally, the statue itself is the creator of the universe. Why wouldn't you believe that?
It's confined in this reality.
It's confined, what do you mean?
This reality that we have.
Yeah? But why can't it be the creator of the universe or the originator of the universe?
Well, if it's the originator of the universe, then it can't be inside the universe, could it?
Why not?
Well, that's illogical.
What about it is illogical? Well, I think you mean irrational, but yeah.
It's something that we can make ourselves.
Yeah, okay, so just so you can imitate something that's eternal doesn't mean it's not eternal.
Suppose it decays over time in some way.
Well, you have currently it doesn't seem to be decaying, so it seems fine to me.
No, we haven't waited very long yet.
Do we have to wait to know if something is not eternal?
How fast it decays.
It's actually even more obvious than that. People are going to like, oh yeah, well, I was going to say that. I was going to say, anyone? I'm going to have one more attempt.
I think it causes it.
Sorry?
It has an end.
It has an end. Yeah. What do you mean? Well, it's existing. It doesn't seem to have an end. Just so, because you can cut it and break it, why is it not eternal? Why is it not something that always existed? You can come in, I'm not that scary.
Why not? The maker.
Sorry?
We know the maker.
We know the maker?
Yeah.
No, well, I said maybe the maker just imitated this carton and made many other cartons, but we have the original eternal carton of which all other cartons are merely a copy of. Give up? Shouldn't be that hard. You know, usually it's intuitive, right? I'm going to try and put it into words for you. The answer is here. Finite. Right? when you define something, it's a Latin word, isn't it? It comes from Latin. De finis. What does that mean? To define means to set its limits, that upon which it exists, circumscribe its existence, right? And then it comes into existence because you've made something giving it limits. Its limitations is its existence. Basically, simple question, if this is an eternal, uncreated carton, then why is it not twice as big, or half as big, or a different color, or a different mass, or made of different substances, not plastic or paper, but perhaps made of gold or silver or something else? Why is it specifically having attributes which are fixed and limited into a certain degree? The very fact that it has limitations which it itself couldn't choose or decide, yet it exists, is a proof that it basically was defined by something other than itself. That's where you get its basic rationality. If this thing was eternal, why did it always exist in this form? Like, what point in eternity did something decide that it was going to be this size? And if it couldn't decide for itself to be this size, then what decided for it? Which means something external to this decided it. But you could take that down to, you could say that's a composite piece of matter. You could take the smallest quark or gauge boson or what have you and say, okay, it has characteristics, it has properties. Why those particular properties and characteristics if it's meant to be eternal particles and things like that? And you get the same conclusion, which is ultimately its limits was defined by something. If it's not, if it can't define itself, which doesn't make sense, i.e. if it, either something brings itself into existence, which you have to exist before you can do that, which is obviously absurd, or it itself is uncreated, but if it's uncreated, that means that nothing gave it its limits. Nothing defined it, means it wouldn't have no limits to itself. Yet, hence, uncreated and infinite is the same. But because that does have limits, then it leads us to the only third possibility, which is it was created by something external to it, or more fundamental than it. For example, you could say, what's smaller than a, or what defines the characteristics of a boson, for example, or a quark? It has certain characteristics, its limitations of how it interacts with other things. What defines that? What's smaller than it, or what's more fundamental than it to actually define it? Ultimately, because usually before we knew about quantum particles, we believed that the smallest particle was basically atoms. And then people ask the question, well, what gives atoms its characteristics? And they discovered, oh, look, it's got smaller things inside it that determine how it works. Right? Or like that clock there, you know? Why does it have two hands which are moving and a third hand which is moving quite fast compared to other two? Oh, it's because of its internal mechanism. So internal to it defines its attributes. So ultimately, we need an explanation for what created the entire universe or defined it, and what is currently supporting it from its most fundamental level, like beyond the quark and the boson or what have you. What is ultimately? Because inside an object there is atoms. Okay, that's great. And then inside atoms there is protons and electrons and neutrons as part of the nucleus. Okay, that's great. And then inside that, oh, there's quarks and there's bosons and what have you. Okay, great. All right, so the properties of a piece of matter comes from the properties and characteristics of its atoms. And the properties and characteristics of its atoms comes from the properties and characteristics within the atom. The subatomic particles of the neutrons, protons, and electrons. And these characteristics come from something within that. Okay, we can keep going infinitum ad infinitum. And if you basically keep going down, if there is no fundamental level that supports all existence, then what you're saying is that there's an infinite chain of smaller and smaller things, which ultimately means that nothing actually exists. Which is an argument which I believe Zeno of Samos, the guy behind the paradoxes, Zeno's paradoxes, he was the one who actually argued that. He used it to argue something else, though, of course, something a different conclusion. But ultimately, reality has to have a fundamental support to it, a starting point, a fundamental underlying force that supports it, and ultimately on the macro scale, it has to have a fundamental cause to everything that exists. Otherwise, you end up with infinite regress fallacies. So this means that you start. The only thing we can deduce is that there's a start point, and in order for it to be a start point and not further the question what created itself, it has to be infinite and therefore have no limitations that require creation. Because some people say, this is a typical argument, they say, okay, so then everything was created, but what created God? What created the first cause? And I say, no, we didn't. That's not the rule. Not the rule is not everything is created. The rule is everything finite is created. That's the rule. So what is infinite doesn't need to be created because it has no limitations that need to be defined by anything else. And so it's a start point. It's the only thing we can deduce. And even in most cosmologies advanced by atheist physicists today, everyone ends up with infinity at some point. The question is, what would you mean by infinity? And does infinity have a will? Which is a big, big question. Okay, so then, ultimately you can deduce, as Plato and Aristotle would put it, this is the first cause behind all things. We say it's infinite and uncreated. Okay, but maybe it's mindless. You know, like a factory production line just produces universes mindlessly. How do we know it actually has a will in the first place? That is assumption, perhaps, right? Well, what is will? So I said will is the ability to initiate action. Okay, so say you had this first cause that makes the universe. The question is, why does it make the universe? Right? If there's three possibilities. One, that it has an internal mechanism inside it. So let me just make a little box here. So either it has an internal mechanism, or something external makes it make universes, let's say. Or it just initiates. Okay, so let's take the first one, internal. Maybe there's an internal mechanism that makes this infinite thing create universes mindlessly. Like that clock over there. If that's the case, then what's making the internal mechanism now make universes? Or maybe there's an even smaller mechanism inside that. Okay, now what makes an even smaller mechanism inside that make universe or initiate the whole process? Or maybe there's, again, so you have a big, like, let's take a clock. And they say, oh, the reason why it moves is because there's a smaller clock inside it. And what makes that move is there's an even smaller clock inside that. And so on and so forth. If there's an infinite amount of smaller and smaller clocks, that this big hand requires to move, would it move at all? If you had to wait for a whole number of an infinite amount of mechanisms to move it? No. It's called, you're right back to the infinite, it's called the infinite regress fallacy. You're right back to that problem. So then it can't be internal. What about external? Maybe there's something outside of this uncreated thing that pushes it to make universes. But guess what? The question is deferred into, well, if something external is making this creator make things, and this creator isn't the first cause, then something else is the first cause. Now, what is that? Then what caused that? And so on and so on and so forth. Again, we end up in the same infinite regress fallacy problem. The only thing that makes sense, and you don't end up with a contradiction and with a fallacy, in infinite regress fallacy, is that it initiates it by itself with no prior cause. And the ability to initiate things without any cause is will, or rather true free will, more free than our will, in fact, because we require causes, right? When people say, why did you do that? I mean, they say, what caused you to do that? Right, so what cause happened? In order for you to have your choice, you have to have a cause. Whereas something that can initiate ex nihilo, initiate with no prior cause, well, that is the very definition of a will, because that means it can choose to initiate things. And that, in a nutshell, ladies and gentlemen, is how we know for absolute certain that God exists, because any other possibility ends up with infinite regress fallacy. A whole infinite things have to happen before this thing happens. And that just can't happen. Because we never reach this point in time, we never reach, nothing would ever move, nothing would ever do anything else if we were somehow infinite in our, we had to wait for infinite amounts of things to happen, or we had infinite structures inside us creating or supporting the universe. And that is basically the argument. Now, I'm just going to go through some counter-arguments. Because, obviously, people being very clever, they're not going to take this line down. So can you move the camera just to the blackboard, because I think maybe someone might, whoever watches it, and who can't make it, be irritated they can't see the blackboard. So, argument number one. People say, they might say, I'm an atheist to every single god. Like you, you're an atheist to every single god except your god. I just go one god further than you. You've probably heard this argument before, right? Let's say I'm an atheist. You're an atheist to every single god except one. And I just go one god further, they argue. And I say, well, actually, no. Anyone in the history of mankind who believes in an infinite, unlimited creator who starts, initiates all things is the same god we worship. It's the exact same god. And many do, even ancient Greeks. Some people like to say, oh, the ancient Greeks, you know, they had a whole different religion to the Abrahamic religions, which came later, right? And isn't like, how comes they didn't get revelation, right? How comes this monotheism of Abraham came much later after the ancient Greeks, right? Have you ever wondered that? Have you wondered, right? Your wondering is wrong, because before, was it 200 to 300 years before Homer and Hesiod wrote the first poems, you could say, summarizing Greek religious thought, 300 years before Homer and Hesiod even existed, who wrote the poems that became very famous, the Iliad and the Theogony and what have you, the kingdom of Israel was existent in the Levant with Mosaic law and one God. So, Jewish religion, the law, the religion of Moses, pre-existed before the ancient Greeks, and even had their own kingdom before the ancient Greeks, even became what you think are the ancient Greeks, before the classical period of ancient Greece, even before the dark ages of ancient Greece. We're talking about what, Bronze Age, just as the Bronze Age was collapsing, you already had the Kingdom of Israel set up by Israelites. So they pre-existed, and the religion of Abraham pre-existed the ancient Greeks. The ancient Greeks came later. So just a little interesting fact that people are quite surprised, but like, really? And if you even need to look at other religions around the world, either from ancient Chinese and the belief of Shangdi, as well as ancient Egyptian religion, most of these cosmologies believed in a first god. There was one god who created other gods, who then created Earth through different mechanisms. But most religions actually believed in one god originally, and even still maintain that one belief. But then over time, as historians will tell you, and archaeologists will tell you, the belief of a god which is ineffable and couldn't be imagined and seemed to be very distant to some people, they thought, you know what, let's make God more relatable to us, and hence let's make a god that we can see looks like us and I can have a relationship with, more than a god that seems distant and disconnected to us, even though if he's infinite and uncreated, so of infinite power and ability, which is what infinite means, without any limitations, you wouldn't require an intercessor to get to access God. God would know about you, right? Surely God would have, he created you, he created everything in this universe, intends everything in this universe to exist that exists. So even your most private thoughts is ultimately caused and created by him intentionally. So how comes he would not know about you? He needs to have an intermediary. Doesn't make rational sense, and this is the message of Islam as well. So the same argument. So the first argument was that. Another argument that you see some atheist Jews is they attempt, call it the nuclear option, which is they say, you know what, let's just destroy any certainty of reality itself and say, how do we know anything exists? Maybe reality is just an illusion. Maybe we're in the matrix. Maybe we're a brain in a vat, for example. Right? How do we know that's not the case? To which I respond, well, I know reality exists, very much so, because I'm experiencing something and I can't control it, so it's a reality external to me, and hence I know for absolute certain that reality exists. Otherwise, what's causing the experience? And then they say, oh, but what about if you're in the Matrix? Or what about if you are not a brain in the vat being manipulated by aliens? And I say, well, firstly, even if we were in the Matrix, or even if we're just brains in the vat being manipulated by aliens, this would still hold true. Because everything around you was still caused by something else, and then you would ultimately end up with the same conclusion whether you were in the Matrix or in the Amazon rainforest, away from all these civilizations of Babylon and Islamic civilization and Christendom and all this stuff. You'd still be able to do exactly the same thing. Xenophanes, the Greek philosopher, certainly does. I don't think he just found an Old Testament Bible lying around, or the Tanakh, as the Jews call it. You can still do this. So it's actually irrelevant. And even if you're brain in the vat, and even if you're in the Matrix, what you're seeing still has a reality to it. You see, a program comes from a hard drive. So the hard drive is causing the electrical signals that will go into your synapse, as well as if you're brain in the vat, again, the aliens are causing electric signals to go into your brain, but it's still coming from somewhere. So even then, they have a reality that's caused. So all things come from somewhere. And even if you're in a delusion, like you're having a fever or in a delusion, your delusion is still coming from misfiring neurons in your brain. It still comes from somewhere. It doesn't come from nowhere. Even if it's an illusion, all it is that you're seeing something that does not approximate to the physical external reality to your body. But it's still coming from somewhere inside yourself. So the argument for nihilism or solipsism falls flat on its face. What about there's an attempted argument, which is, okay, maybe this universe was created. Okay, I'll angle it this way now. We'll angle it this way, inshallah, just to or just get as wide as possible so I can go back and forth. Right. Then some people might say, maybe this universe was created by something else that's infinite, and some atheists might concede this. But they say, this is maybe an infinite thing that just makes multiple universes, a multiverse of some kind. Right? Makes infinite amounts of universes, and we happen to be in one universe amongst infinite amount of universes. And I say, and then they'll also argue, they'll say, if you think that this universe was finely tuned for life, maybe there's infinite universes of every variation, and we happen to be in the universe that has life, because if it didn't have life, we wouldn't be around to notice that it has life in it. And they give the example of, it's not like rolling 1,000 dice and getting all sixes in one go. It's more like you can't enter the casino until you've rolled 1,000 dice enough times, and that you get all sixes and all the dice. Let's say that was the argument they make, and I say that's really great. It's a really nice argument. I'm very very creative. I like the simile there. However, who's rolling the dice, and why they're rolling dice? So the multiverse. Why is it making universes? Again, you come right back to this argument that refutes it. Is there an internal mechanism that's making universes? Then that's more fundamental. Is there an external mechanism that's making the multiverse make universes? Then that's more fundamental. And ultimately, you have to get to a point that something initiates it of its own choice, and that's not a mindless multiverse. Then that becomes God, basically. It's not a multiverse. So that would be an argument. And if you think, oh, multiverse seems to be a brand new argument based on science, well, it's not. It has as much scientific evidence for multiverse as Zeus, Odin, and Thor, but it's taken as a scientific theory because atheists with nice white coats convince you. But the white lab coats tell you that it's a theory, and you think, oh, it must be a scientific theory because men of science or women of science are saying it. Well, no, there's no evidence for it. It's just a hypothesis because they need to get around the idea of what ultimately causes this universe to exist, and they can't get around the infinite regress fallacy. So they say, all right, fine, it's infinite, uncreated, but it doesn't have a will. That's their attempt to concede, but it doesn't help them. And they're not even the first people to come up with it. The first atomists of ancient Greece, Leucippus and Democritus, these are before Socrates, for those of you who want to know. The first atomists came up with a belief that the universe was not created, and everything was made of atoms, things which literally atomos, meaning uncuttable. You couldn't divide it any further. They just exist. And the question is, well, if they just exist, then how come there's a finite number of them? And they said, no, there isn't. There's an infinite number of atoms. They wanted to get around that. And then it was argued, but if there's an infinite amount of atoms, then how comes the universe isn't just filled with atoms? And there's no space. How come there's lots of space? And they said, oh, well, That's because there must be other universes to take the excess, the other infinites. There must be infinite universes, or infinite cosmos, as they say. So they're the ones who first came up, the first atheists to come up with the idea of an infinite number of universes to avoid the consequence of God, basically. Atomists. The argument, generally speaking, some people say, well, maybe the universe itself is infinite and hence doesn't need to be created. I say, well, that you might believe that, but it's certainly not by the fact that it's filled with things which are finite. You could even turn Zeno's paradoxes upon them by saying, if the universe was infinite, then firstly, why is it not filled up with everything? It's just chock-a-block with stuff. There's no space, but of course, if you have an infinite universe, so if this expanse was infinite, then any two points in this universe would also be infinite, and you couldn't travel from one place to the next, which is an argument that Zeno produced, defending a different doctrine. He actually believed the universe was infinite, but everything you see is just an illusion, and there's actually no change. In fact, the universe is what they would call God, and we're all one thing, one continuous thing, unchanging, uncreated, and what you're seeing in terms of change is just an illusion of your mind. So that sounds interesting, Parmenides, Zeno, and et al. And Melissus, but the problem is, how come there is change? Where are we seeing change and finite things? Where are they coming from? Where are we experiencing these things? And they couldn't answer that question, and hence they were generally laughed at for their ideas, although Zeno's paradoxes generally are still here today. Some people say, I only believe God if I can see him, and I say, well, then you must be saying that you're God, because if you're saying that, then you only see something, you only believe something if you can see it directly, then are you discounting or denying that there's a reality outside your senses? In essence, if you haven't seen it, it doesn't exist. So if you haven't been to China, China doesn't exist. If you haven't seen with your own eyes Mars, Mars doesn't exist. If you haven't seen black holes, they don't exist either, and you can't see them. You can only see their effects and their lensing effects on the light, starlight coming from stars behind them, going in our direction. They cause a lensing effect, but you wouldn't be able to see them directly. So the argument I only believe things that I can see is quite ridiculous. And ultimately speaking, this whole argument is to explain what causes what we can see. And that's what rationality is all about. Reason is defined as a thinking about causes. The word why means what's the cause. What is the cause behind something? So the argument is kind of, it's ridiculous in the fact that you can't deny what you can see. You can say, I only believe what I can see. You're basically saying, I don't want to think about what causes what I can see. And that's basically ridiculous. Other argument you might have heard is Occam's razor argument. They say that God is a most complicated explanation, more complicated than the universe, and hence Occam's razor, which is you take the simplest explanation, they argue, hence there is no God, because God is more complicated than arguing what, that the universe isn't created. Well, actually, no, because the concept of God is actually very simple. The belief that there's only one unified thing, it's not multiple parts in it. It's not more, actually, the universe is quote-unquote more complicated because it has multiplicity inside it, whereas God doesn't have multiplicity. In fact, God is completely simple from the understanding of what we call Tawheed, belief in one, it's one, the oneness of God. Right? Not God has different parts. So the argument kind of falls flat on its face, and besides, are we worshipping Occam? Do we have to use, that we always have to use his razor? It doesn't even apply, though, but it's not an argument anyway. It's a rhetorical argument. People say, we can't know for certain that God exists, therefore all religions that demand certainty are false. Or you prove that you can know God exists, therefore if any religion demands that you should believe in it with certainty, it has a right to demand that, because you should be able to come to that conclusion from yourself. Some people try to argue, do you have any mathematicians here? Any math students? Oh, you're a math student. Okay, so you're probably aware of Cantor and infinite sets. Okay, this is the point where you say, you know what, that's next season, next module, yeah?
First season, all right, well, you'll get to it. So some people say, some atheists will say, and they actually have in my debates with them, they say, well, you think that infinite regress doesn't make sense, but maybe infinity can coexist with finite things because look at the set of natural numbers, otherwise people call it the number line, but the set of natural numbers, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and they say, it goes on forever, it's infinite. It's infinite, so you have an infinity within a finite universe. To which I point out that, no, you don't. What you have is base 10 counting. It's a counting system for base 10. It can only go up to as much as you can imagine, or as much as a computer processor and RAM can compute. But it's only used for counting. It can't be used for more than that. I mean, yeah, calculations, things, but it's a counting of base 10 counting. You go up to 10, go up to 9, then you add a zero, and you continue, and you add another digit, and then you continue. And that's how it works, base 10 counting system. You know, Babylonians had base 60, but that was quite complicated. But base 10, that's all you have. It's not, you don't have, the number line doesn't exist somewhere in the universe or outside the universe, like Plato's Platonic forms, where he believed all concepts had a separate existence somewhere. So we have chairs, and out there was a chair somewhere, the universal chair upon which all chairs are based upon, that universal chair, right? And the number 1, 2, 3, 4 must also exist somewhere as a separate, in a separate existence. Doesn't exist. Plato's Platonic forms, I dare say, doesn't exist in reality. So to say the number line is infinite that we can use, no. And even in maths equations, right? What is math? People say, oh, well, surely in some of our mathematical theories, infinities are predicted or produced. The problem is this. Mathematics is just basically a way of modeling things. It's a model based on axioms. And what physicists does is they try to produce a model and then try to find a pattern in the universe that matches the model, and they then assume that, well, hopefully, then that the universe functions as this model that we have developed says it should. But every time they have a model that produces, in some cases, an infinity, for example, they have a way of addressing it called renormalization, meaning they basically have to fudge it because they know that infinity that can't exist in the universe, and it produces problems. And it shows that the mathematical model doesn't hold in all circumstances. I'll give you one example. It's called the ultraviolet paradox. I'm not going to actually... ultraviolet catastrophe, sorry, is what it's called. I'm not going to go into depth about it. But basically, they calculate that if you have an object that's a perfectly black object, so it absorbs light and it has a little slit in it, and basically if you fire electromagnetic waves at it at a certain frequency, and it will basically bounce around inside it, the mathematics, their original model predicted that it would produce an infinite amount of ultraviolet radiation being emitted. An infinite amount of radiation basically will just destroy everything in the universe, right? And they call it the ultraviolet catastrophe. Of course, in experiments, destruction never happened. There was no one destroying the universe, no one with a golden glove clicking their fingers and causing things to be destroyed. If you don't know that reference, then sorry, forget about it. And then they had to fudge the equations. And now, until they found a better mathematical model that explained the data and works in most circumstances. Renormalization, physicists do it all the time. If your equation predicts infinity, it means something wrong with it. And then some people say, oh, but if you take 1/2 and then you add 1/4 and then you add 1/8 and you keep doing that ad infinitum, it adds up to 1. So surely you can have infinity in the finite. And I say, well, no, you can't, because this requires you to actually complete this equation to infinity, right? So what you'll end up is you'll basically end up with 0.99999999 as you add more and more of those fractions. But you can never complete all those fractions to infinity, and hence you'll never reach one in the real world. So they like to play little math games with people, confuse people with these math games, but the mathematics is just a human model
trying to map what is in the universe.
But every time they find infinity predicted by the model, they realize that they've made a mistake. So there is no finite in infinite things. They argue, the next two arguments would be very simple. They say, using Julius Robert Mayer's first law of thermodynamics called the law of conservation of energy,
nothing is created or destroyed because within a closed system, actually I'm going to rub this stuff out now, in a closed system, if they would make a closed system with different objects, would have you firing energy at each other or hitting each other, the total amount of energy would not change in that system, right? And so they say energy is either created or destroyed, therefore we don't need a God. But then, in recent times, they've discovered other things like virtue particles, and perhaps there's something called a quantum foam, which is just hypothesized, that things can pop out of existence, so they say, from nothing, virtual particles like types of gluon and what have you, and then they pop out of existence. And they do so, and then they argue, well, look, things can come from nothing and can go into nothing, therefore, we don't need a creator. So the first argument was, energy is either created or destroyed, we don't need God. Energy is created and destroyed, we don't need God. Atheism, according to its own precepts, is unfalsifiable if you make the assumption that everything you see will just justify atheism. Right. Well, first and foremost, with this whole virtual particles, they say, you know what's funny? If the classical physicists discovered that energy conservation didn't hold and energy was being created and destroyed, people would say, oh, you know what, maybe God is interacting with the universe as we see it, and is actively creating things and destroying things every day, every moment. Right? And certainly the Islamic classical doctrine, medieval doctrine of occasionalism, Google that, certainly posited that every moment in time is being created, and every past moment in time is being destroyed, so God is moving the universe like a movie reel, a film reel. It's like each segment is being so what you see is change, is God just creating each new moment and destroying the previous moment, right? Anyway, so if you see particles pop from out of nothing, why would you conclude that God doesn't exist? You could argue, well, that proves God exists. And then the atheists would go back, oh, no, you're just saying that as a God of the gaps argument because we don't know where these vertical particles come from. I said, yeah, but before you were saying that they come from nothing. And now when we say, oh, maybe God did it, but now you're going to now shift the goalposts back to, oh, well, just because we don't know doesn't mean it's God. Right? But yet you were very confidently saying that we don't know, but I know it's nothing. It's coming from nothing. How do you know it's coming from nothing? Maybe it's coming from a different dimension, or different universe, or different layer underneath this universe. How do you know where it's coming from? When you say confidently, it's nothing, comes from nothing. Remember, they won't make any argument to avoid the obvious conclusion, which is fundamentally everything has to be initiated by God and is constantly being supported by God.
By the infinite uncreated thing, which has a will. Then they say, falsifiability, they say.
A belief in God is not falsifiable, and therefore, it's Karl Popper's argument from last century. He just said so. Therefore, it can't be a valid theory of things. And I say, yeah, but tell me what evidence you require to believe in God. If you saw chariots coming down from the sky and a voice from the sky, you'll just say, oh, this might be aliens, or I'm hallucinating, I shouldn't have smoked that weed, what have you, right? That's what they'd say, right? That's what they say. And the Quran says, very interestingly, little is it that they believe. Is that little is it that if you have limited your mind to exclude the possibility that God exists, then you'll always explain everything you see by reference to it being something other than God. There's nothing that could be presented to you that would change your mind. Therefore, atheism is also unfalsifiable if it assumes the conclusion. At least with theism, we can show rationally, deduce rationally why it's the only explanation that avoids contradictions for reality itself, right? So unfalsifiable, and of course, saying unfalsifiable, I mean, it's just like saying, it's like me saying, okay, well, is this the existence of this apple carton, is it falsifiable? And they say, well, yeah, of course, because if it didn't exist, then you wouldn't see anything. And I say, okay, well, if that's your argument, then if God doesn't exist, then nothing would exist. But the fact that things exist means God exists. I could make the same counter-argument back. And of course, as the Quran describes, everything is an ayat of Allah, in the Arabic meaning a sign of God's existence. So everything that we see is a sign of God's existence.
Just to, last point, I think, only 2 points. There's a big one. They say the problem of evil,
they say, denies God's existence. I mean, basically, it doesn't deny God's existence. It's just an argument about the character of God. And so if you want to bring it up in the Q&A, we can discuss that. I'm more than happy to. But the problem of evil, saying, why are there suffering in the world? And I always ask, well, you're making an assumption that God created us to enjoy infinite, unlimited pleasures, for example, with no suffering. That's an assumption. And then people take that assumption, look at the world, it doesn't fit their assumption. Instead of saying, maybe my assumption's wrong, maybe my understanding of God is wrong. No, they say, oh, God doesn't exist. Right? Because in this liberal world today, liberalism, where it's all about pleasure, the purpose of people's lives is pleasure, and God, they believe God exists, but their life isn't 100% pleasurable, therefore, no, liberalism, the liberal assumption of our purpose in life can't be wrong, so maybe then God doesn't exist. Now, wait a second, who told you your purpose of life is unlimited, constant, and unremitting pleasure? Who told you that? Right, apart from the TV commercials, right?
Anyway, and the last point, and this is the old chestnut of any atheist today, it's due to relativism, really. They say, oh, in quantum mechanics, things are counterintuitive, right? An electron can be in two places at the same time. You can't know the speed and position of a particle, or some sort of particle, at the same time. This will show you that using the mind doesn't help you with science because things are counterintuitive. And I facepalm whenever I kind of hear that because, see, this is not the first time humans have made assumptions about things and then thought it was intuitive, these assumptions. Right? So the ancient Greeks basically believed that, okay, for those who did believe that the planets go around the Earth or the stars go around the Earth, and even for those, there was one particular Greek person who believed that the Sun is the center of the solar system and all the planets, including Earth, go around the Sun, Aristarchus. They believe that if something goes around something, it must be a circle. It has to be a circle. Circle is a perfect shape. It's nice, it's equidistant. Each radius is all the same. It's equidistant. So it must be a circle, right? Surely it has to be a circle. And then when they encountered that their calculations where the planets have to be don't fit, you know, seeing planets here and planets there and planets there, like, what's going on? Now, did they freak out and say, you know what? The universe doesn't make sense. No point rationalizing about it. No point using our brain about it. Universe is just contradictory. It's all relative, or you can't understand anything about the universe, right? No. They thought about it. Of course, Islamic astronomers also came into play on this matter. And it was, of course, we had to wait until Kepler came along to give the exact kind of calculations, although some people believe that Islamic scientist Al-Tusi helped make it possible for Kepler to come up with his model by means of the Tusi couple. Google it. But basically, it's an elliptical orbit discovered, right? And it satisfies the laws of gravitation. Of course, Newton confirmed it with his, and also provided a theory that would explain it. Of course, then they discovered that actually the Sun is not exactly at the center of the solar system. Everyone is actually, all the planets are actually orbiting a particular point due to gravity, of course, because the Sun forms a kind of a little dance with each of the planets, and so it wobbles and it moves out of place. Anyway, long story. Sorry for you astronomers in the audience to explain to your fellows. They discovered that, okay, actually, you know, it's elliptical, that makes sense. They never said, oh, well, you know, our scientific observations don't match or rationality, therefore science doesn't make sense, the universe can't be rationalized. No, they realized, we made an assumption. We made an assumption that orbits have to be circular because we like the shape. Okay, so if you're seeing an electron seemingly at two places at the same time, it doesn't mean that the universe can't be understood. It means that your model, the electron, currently is wrong. What you think the electron is, or any other subatomic particle, might be completely wrong, which is why it's producing strange results.
And all our ancestors who were scientists, whenever they encountered contradiction, because they regularly encountered contradiction, they realized that they had just been making an assumption. Right? Because rationally speaking, there's no reason why electron can't produce experimental results that appear to make it look like it's in two places at the same time. Because maybe an electron is something on a different plane or dimension. Let's say I'm just speculating here. So maybe this is our plane, and there's a plane underneath this, and an electron exhibits itself in two places in our world, maybe, and we see it in two different places here. But really, it's actually underneath somewhere in one place, for example. Or maybe it's not even a particle. Maybe it's just a fluctuation. Maybe it's a vibration of a quantum string. Who knows, right? Science can look at that. Rationality doesn't tell you any particular way. You can't rationalize. You can only make assumptions and then retrospectively call it rationality. It's not. The universe is very rationalizable. And if you throw out rationality, then you throw out the scientific method with it, because it's based upon rationality. The idea that you make an experiment, you make one tweak to experiment, and then you get a different result. You make another tweak, and you get a different result. Just A, result A, result B, what have you. Then you know there must be a causal relation, probably. Right? That's all based on rationality. So, anyway, that's basically my presentation. So thank you for listening. I look forward to your questions and comments, but as you could see, that basically proving God's existence is simple. Every civilization, most civilizations already came to it naturally, or they received what I would call revelation, or what Islam would say is revelation, separately, for their own prophets, perhaps. But ultimately speaking, you don't even need a prophet to tell you that God exists. Even a simple child, when a simple rationality of a human being, of a little kid, when that kid asks their embarrassed parents, where do babies come from? It's because the kid recognizes that babies don't pop out of thin air. They come from somewhere, and that somewhere, they want to know where that somewhere is, right? They know basic causality. Why? The question why. All these counter-arguments, all you're seeing is just human ingenuity to be creative, to deny the obvious. And that is basically, unfortunately, seen throughout history and will constantly repeat itself as people make new arguments to deny the obvious, just like flat earthers will make new and very ingenious arguments to deny the obvious. So, JazakAllah khair for listening. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to your questions and comments.
JazakAllah khair, Abdullah, for that lecture. Just because I'm conscious of time again, like not yesterday, we'll take a few questions. So, if you do have any questions, you have them.
Questions, comments, or contentions. If you disagree with anything I've said, please come back to me. In fact, as I always say, I actually prefer debates than lectures, because it's very easy to sound convincing when no one's challenging you on the same platform. So I always prefer debates. But so if you have any contentions, I'd actually prefer that. But you, sir, in the front. Yeah.
Thank you very much. That was very interesting. Also a bit mind-blowing, to be quite honest. It's very difficult to take these things in when we're talking about infinite mass and things like that, isn't it? And relativity and so on. Concepts that our minds certainly don't find easy to comprehend, and and you rush through that very quickly. I certainly found it difficult to follow up points, but with something which did occur to me while you were speaking, and it was about uncreated and created and so on. Mm. Especially because, you know, this is an Islamic society and you're a Muslim, and it's about the nature of the Quran. Okay. Is the Quran created, or is it uncreated?
Okay, interesting question. You're probably aware of the philosophical debates that Muslims have had.
I have heard that some Muslims say it's uncreated, okay? But I'm not sure all Muslims say that or not.
Okay, well,
So how would you answer that?
Well, to simplify the debates that we're having, so it was usually a semantical debate between the Mu'tazilite school of thought and other schools of thought, like the Asharites and Athis and many others in the classical Islamic period. So the argument was that the Quran, and in fact everything that exists, actually comes from will, the will of the Creator, and the Creator is not created, then is everything ultimately in concept or formal knowledge created? So basically the Mu'tazilites just outwardly said, because they use some basic logics, logic can produce basic conclusions, not nuanced ones. Rationality does a bit more, because it doesn't make assumptions or based on syllogism. But they argue that, no, the Quran isn't is created, and, like, so what?
But it is created.
Yeah, it's created, like everything else is created, right?
Yeah.
And they said that, and they said there's no Islamic text that contradicts that, so they stuck to their guns on that issue. The majority opinion was that the physical book, the ink, the knowledge in people's minds, and minds themselves that contain the Quran being a recitation of God's word, being only the recitation of it, all these things are created, yes, but the Quran in its form of knowledge, the knowledge that the words encode, is the express will of God, and because God is not created, therefore his knowledge, which is viewed to be a part of his, is the same as his will, is also uncreated. So everything that exists, the knowledge of it was uncreated, you understand, and merely just expressed by the creation process. But everything that exists in creation, and any Quran physical book, the ink on it, or any human mind who's memorized the Quran, the word Quran means recitation, the reciting of God's word. So it's basically God is the one who expressed his will, revealed it, and the Quran is merely the words used to encode and a recitation of it. So then, basically, the Quran as a physical book is created, yes, and your memory of the Quran in your minds is also created, and you, because your mind itself is created, and all these things are created, other than the knowledge that the words in the Quran encode, which is uncreated, and they'd also argue that everything else in the universe was created by God's knowledge, is also the knowledge of it, God's will, God, you know, is uncreated, but the things are created things. Understand. So if you think like this, it's like the templates. To use a crude analogy, it's like basically a builder comes to a work construction site with pre-made templates. The building is made, is created by the builder, but the template isn't. It's just given to the builder to create, let's say. Although the analogy falls down because the template itself would also be created too. Yes, but just so you know the difference between.
Go back into an input regress again.
No, because in God's knowledge, God's knowledge is infinite. Right? Hence, there's no limitations. So when God creates, I'm going to use an analogy here, he merely selects something from his infinite knowledge to then make actual.
Yeah.
You understand? So his knowledge is of infinite potential, has no limitation to it. And hence, every permutation that could ever, to an infinite degree, ever possibly be, or could be, that he could make, already exists in his knowledge. Right? Meaning, he has no limitations, basically. So what we're seeing is him picking from his knowledge what he wants to make. And he makes it, and the creation is created, yes. That makes sense. Anyone else?
I have two questions. I don't know that much about Islam, so I was wondering how it sort of fits or doesn't fit with evolution.
The evolution argument, yeah.
But not an argument, just like as a theory.
Oh, okay. As a theory, so the issue of evolution, I would say that whatever we discover about the natural world doesn't overlap or could contradict Islam. And because there's two things here. One of them is that many Muslims made a lot of assumptions adopting unfortunate, should we say, Protestant, Baptist, American Christian thought, right, on this matter, right, who reacted against Charles Darwin's hypothesis because atheists at the time of Charles Darwin were using that to attack religion. So they reacted instinctively. Well, whereas the Catholic Church just accepted it, that evolution was correct, with no fight, basically. But what then Muslims adopted later on was the Christian arguments against evolution as a possible theory for let's say, the evolution of animals. I'll give you an example. I'll finish by that. Sorry?
Did you
come
say
back?
The Catholic Church just accepted evolution?
Yeah, they didn't seem to fight it or denounce it or what have you. They just were silent on the matter. They left, at least back then when the theory first came out. Okay. What most Muslims don't realize is that Sultan Abdul Hamid II, the Ottoman Caliph, actually commissioned the first discussion on the issue of evolution itself for Muslims to understand their position on the matter. And it was actually much more sophisticated than Muslim responses today, which is quite an indictment. But I guess we don't have a caliphate today, so there you go. Right, to commission such research, right? Anyway. Basically, the Quran doesn't talk about how God made animals. then Muslims started to debate, ah, oh, but animals are not created by evolution, they're created by... It's like, wait a second, where did you get the argument that animals were created by miraculousness, by a miracle, something that was outside the laws of the universe? Where did you get that from as Muslims? Oh, but we heard in these glossy books by certain Turkish individuals imitating Christian arguments that, when I say Christian, Baptist, American Christian arguments, so these ones were specific branch of Baptists from the United States called the Fundamentalists, or as they were called later on, the Fundamentalists, based on their ideas on adopting a set of books called the Fundamentals, long story. They basically, Muslims adopted it and just rode the bandwagon, and it caused lots of trouble for us, because then you saw Muslims trying to argue against the possibility of evolution in animals, when we should just say, look, that's for scientists to look at. It doesn't interact with the Quran, doesn't affect Islamic doctrine or belief. We don't need to go there. The only thing pertinent to Muslims is the origin of Adam alayhi salam, the first human being of the tribe of Adam alayhi salam, right? And that's very pertinent because, okay, so Adam alayhi salam could have been made miraculously. So what? He didn't have parents. So what? Does it mean that he doesn't have a genome that's like all the genomes on the earth? I'll give one example, yeah? There's a time when, so Prophet Jesus, we also believe in Jesus, by the way. So if you haven't realized that, and that's going to be a later lecture this week, sorry for spoilers. He made a clay bird, and he asked God's permission to make the bird become alive. And so the bird came alive. So I have a simple question. So God made that bird, turned it from a clay bird into a living bird. So I have a simple question to everybody. What's the genome of that bird? Does it resemble any previous bird that was known to the people of the Levant? If it did, then surely it would have the same genetic structure, the same genome as any other bird of its species, right? Even though it was created miraculously. So if you were to study that bird, that bird mated with other birds and had little chicks and what have you, and then they had chicks and they had chicks and they had chicks, and you studied their genome, you wouldn't be able to decipher from looking at the genome what the origin of that, whether that bird came in miraculously or not, right? You wouldn't know. So science can't prove or disprove miracles, basically. Right? Things that happen by direct intervention of God's existence. And that's the short response to it. If you want to ask for, okay, but how do you explain maybe similarities in retroviral inclusions in the human genome? Any biologists here? Is anyone biology? Okay, so you know what I'm talking about, I think. Was that all that we just started and we haven't got to that module yet? Okay. Yeah, all right, well, when you do, it could have been that maybe Allah wa'alam, God knows best, when God describes in the Quran that it's interesting, he makes the universe from nothing, but then it's described that he makes us with his hands, right? It's a metaphor for those who adopt that opinion, of course. That he was making some of the hands or shaping it from a clay, being what's used in the Quran, the kind of analogy of that. It means you made something from pre-existing material, right? So is it possible then that evolution is God's shaping with his hands of life up until you get a point where you get hominids, and then when hominids are created as a template, God then Xerox meaning like photocopies, if you remember what Xerox refers to, photocopies a template and makes it into a human being, but this human being has intellect, unlike other hominids, and then has the same genome as other hominids. And of course, but maybe we have retroviral inclusions because of lateral genetic transference between species, that crosses species. There's a whole number of speculations you could go into, but whatever science uncovers doesn't contradict the Quran. Because science can't prove or disprove miracles in the first place. And yeah, we accept microevolution when observed amongst bacteria and things like that. If you want to call it evolution, of course, the debate on evolution is still out there among scientists. And that's great, let the scientists resolve it. When they come to a firm, definite conclusion, then we'd be willing to examine what that idea is. And then our theologians would speculate as to how that makes us understand the Quran better. Right. Of course, there really are very strong arguments from the Quranic verses that seem very explicitly to justify animal evolution and things like that, God replacing something with another species and and successes and change, how God changes things on the earth and brings about things. So these things is not, in fact, some people have argued that the Quran fully strongly supports an animal evolution. Anyway, what I'm going to say is, Allahu A'lam, God knows best. I'll let the scientists resolve it. And when they do come to a firm conclusion, I think I will find that it does not contradict the Quran in the slightest. Because it could never anyway. Considering that the only belief we have, the minimum belief we have, is that Adam alayhi salam, the head of our tribe, right, had no parents. That's it. That's the minimum belief we have on the matter. Nothing beyond that. Was there other tribes? Were not given intellect? Maybe. Other hominids? Maybe. Who knows? Anyone else?
Does it specifically say that in the Quran that Adam doesn't have a parent? Like, in the Quran, does it specifically say?
It said, the gentleman asked, does it say, specifically say in the Quran that Adam alayhi salam doesn't have parents? It likens Adam alayhi salam to Jesus, in that Jesus never had a father, and Adam alayhi salam actually, you know, is one more than that, didn't have a mother as well as a father. So we rely on the Prophet's narrations to talk about, to describe that, and present to us that Adam alayhi salam had no parents. So that the teaching of the Prophet Muhammad, narrations narrated by the Prophet Muhammad, to the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, where we've got narrations where he's explaining that obviously Adam alayhi salam had no parents, and the Quran basically likens Adam alayhi salam to Jesus, in the fact that the only possibility is that Jesus and Adam, what's their similarity, right? It's because they didn't have the full parentage, full providence heritage from their parents. So that would be the only similarity that makes sense. I mean, while some people have looked at the possibility of maybe it doesn't mean absolute for certain that Adam alayhi salam didn't have parents, it would be a very, very weak interpretation. You'd be stretching it a bit. But it is definite that Adam alayhi salam existed. I've heard some people who are like secular reformers trying to reinterpret the Quran to make it fit any current popular vogue opinions, and they will try to say that Adam alayhi salam is just an analogy or a metaphor for humans or mankind, which doesn't make sense considering that he does some very specific things as a person in the Quran, as a particular being in the Quran, one being. So, yeah. But that's like for you to look into anyway. I would advise you to look into it yourself. Anyway, but as I said, Jesus alayhi salam, we have no problem with him not having a father. So why are we having a problem with Adam alayhi salam not having a father or mother? Anyone else? Cowed you into silence? I know I can bite my head off if I mention my... If anyone has any contentions, like if you disagree with anything, or you want me to bring more proof or something that makes sense to you, bring it up. I'll be gentle. You madam, get it.
I didn't fully get your apple juice carton argument. I'm not trying to argue that it is like the eternal
apple juice carton.
Although that's what it sounds like.
Don't tell me I have a convert to apple juicism.
I guess since you said that you were trying to disprove it, like disprove the fact that it's eternal by saying like that we didn't actually see it be created, so we couldn't know that it was created. We couldn't know because we didn't see it with our own eyes when it was produced.
Yeah, okay. If you want to be an extreme empiricist, then yeah.
Well, I mean, that's what you said.
Yeah.
But then you said that it was designed by somebody and that it's limited because its properties were not chosen by itself of its own will. But so why don't we have to see who the person is who designed it?
Oh, so why don't we see who designed something before we can believe it was designed by something?
Well, I mean, yeah, why didn't that matter?
Well, I generally don't use an apple carton, I generally use a rock.
But it comes down to the same thing.
Yeah, but rock isn't made by a conscious person, usually, I don't think. Yeah.
Again, like, do we know that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we haven't yet seen a naturally occurring rock being made by a person, hence it wouldn't be naturally occurring. But generally speaking, we know the whole point of a geologist. And the reason why geologists get up in the morning and do their work with confidence is that they know that before they even became a geologist, that rocks came from somewhere, right? Without even needing to be told where they come from. Even a kid will ask where the rocks come from. Why is that? It's because they know that a rock couldn't make itself, because to make itself, it would have to already exist, which doesn't make sense. If it always existed like that, if it was not created, then why does it exist in its shape, color, and form, which are very specific, right? So then the question is, really, what we're asking when we ask what creates something, what we're asking is, where did the limitations come from?
Right.
That's what we're really asking.
Yeah.
Right. Where did those limits come from? So when you were, let's say if I start this lecture and I came in and I was completely just colored blue, right? You'd ask, why are you colored blue, Abdullah? And ISOC, why are you inviting people like this? Right? What you're asking is that what was the cause of one of my attributes being, or characteristics being blue, when I have a completely blue colored skin and everything and suit, where did that come from? Where did that attribute come from? Where did that limitation come from? I wasn't a different color, right? I wasn't orange, for example, in ruling the United States of America. So instead I was blue. So whenever you ask what creates something, what you're actually asking is, what defined it? What determined its limitations?
Yeah.
What its attributes? And that's ultimately what it is. So if you see anything that has limitations or attributes, then the question is, where did those things come from? Because if something is eternal, let's say if something, you can think of it from the other aspect, other end. If something was never created, had no creation, so nothing defined its attributes, nothing gave it limits, then it has no limits, and therefore shouldn't look like a limited thing.
So is a limit just being one thing instead of all things? So if it was an unlimited color, it would be all colors or no color?
No, if it was unlimited, it wouldn't even have color.
Okay.
Color, dimension, or anything, which is quantifiable.
Okay.
Which is why we don't believe that God looks like a creature. And just so you know, for any of you feminists in the audience, when we say he, referring to God, it's not because God is male. That's ridiculous. God is not subject to the sexual dimorphism of created beings. It's just another word instead of just saying it, because he conveys personality. And in the Arabic language, like in the English anyway, sometimes he can be used as a gender-neutral kind of pronoun, at least in the Arabic language. It just means that it has a will. Hence, you can't call it. It just means it doesn't have a will. It's like inanimate. Whereas something that has a will should be referred to with a pronoun that denotes personality. So, but we don't believe God is male. Hell no. So if you're a feminist, you can believe in the Islamic God without believing that you're dominated by a male. Anyone else?
Can I ask a question? I need further clarification.
Mm.
See that in the Quran, Allah didn't speak about creation of animals. I didn't get the point.
Allah didn't speak about
animals.
The creation of animals.
Yeah.
So, look, in the Quran, it discusses that all things that happen in this universe are God's will. Everything that happens is intended by God. Everything comes about by God's decision, and therefore you could say God creates everything, right? But it does not say how, with kayfiyyah in Arabic, with howness, how God made animals.
But there's a
verse
in Surah Nuh. Yeah. That's chapter 24, verse 45.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
but we.
Animals.
Well, that things that God made living creatures from water.
Yeah.
But how's the evolution argument going to refute that? Because they agree. Well, people who argue that would agree that all living creatures came from water. It makes most of our bodies up, so how would they disagree with that? Yeah? So, what's the problem? Yeah. Yeah, of course, yeah. No. But how did God make things from water? Does the Quran say that?
Oh, the stages.
Yes.
There are five stages.
No. How did he make all living creatures from water?
specify.
Exactly, that's my point.
Okay.
Yeah. That's my point.
For the clarification.
Oh, no. I mentioned how. I mentioned how. I mean, in the Quran, it mentions that all living things are made from water, yes. But it didn't mention how God created all these different creatures, how giraffes were created, or how camels were created, or penguins were created, or anything like this. It didn't mention, like, did it just pop into existence, or did it come by a process of molding, should we say? Or was, didn't explain the kefir. That's what else. That's, so anyway. Anyone else? Questions, comments, or contentions? I suppose I should just mention that later on in the week, so we've got to discussion as to God's existence and that he made everything and that everything has everything that exists is intended to exist. It's intended. Now, if something is intended, that means it has meaning or purpose, because if something was made with intention, it has a purpose. It means it was made with purpose. And purpose conveys meaning, because without creation, without this universe being created by something that has a will, there is no meaning behind anything. Because it would just be, if it was mindless, then there's no meaning, there's no purpose, there's no intent. Right? What is a word, right? For a word to have a meaning, like if I take the word infinite, right? For this word to have a meaning, or initiate, or eternal, or external, for any of these words to have a meaning, there must be an intended purpose behind using this word. The word was formed for a purpose. So if I'm going to tell you, if I want to use the word internal, I am intending by that the meaning of something inside or something within, something else. There's a meaning behind it. So if I give you that word, if I tell you that word, I'm conveying to you with a purpose, a particular meaning. If this universe was created by God intentionally, then everything has a meaning behind it. Everything that happens has meaning, has an intention behind it. It was intended to happen for a purpose. So then the next question is, well, then what is the purpose of life? And what is the purpose of inanimate objects, animate objects, the plants, animals, and of course, us as a subset of that, human beings. And that, I think, will be left for a lecture later on this week. Well, that they will pick that question up and continue it. So we've got to this point, we've actually proving that universe and everything in it does have a meaning to it, does have an intent, does have a purpose. Now the question is, because all these things that exist with certain attributes, the question is, what is that purpose? Like if you look at a car, if you were to examine a car, right, and you've never seen it before, let's say you're from, I don't know, the 11th century, and you would look at, see a car, you were transported in time and introduced to a car, and let's say you were a really great scientist and you had the tools to take things apart, you wouldn't know what car is, but you'd begin to study it, and if you were really clever and you understood, someone explained to you about chemical combustion of petroleum and things like that, you could deduce by looking at its attributes what it's intended to do. So now the question is, the reason why we know is because if it has an intention behind it, we can see that from that its attributes must reflect that intention, right? So that the purpose of a car is what? What's the purpose of a car? Sorry?
Transportation. From one place to another.
Yeah, from one place to another. So that means that everything about the car should facilitate transportation of a human being from one place to another. We can add in comfort of some kind, right? So these attributes reflect its purpose. So therefore, the question that we picked up later on in this week, I believe, will be, okay, so by observing the attributes of everything that exists, what can we deduce are our purpose, and do we require revelation, so the creator of the universe, to give us some information that we can't deduce ourselves, and even language, where did that come from, right? Because our brains, yeah, if you look at them as computers, do we need software for it, and where does that come from? To enable us to determine what we're meant to be doing as creatures, and what does the creator of the universe intend for us to do? So that will be coming later on this week. I kind of discussed it with my colleague Hamza about this. That you take this, and I'll get you up to this point, then he'll take the reins from there. So that'll be the next lecture. Anyone have any final questions, comments, contentions. Is there anything you want clarified, or anything you just disagree with? No one's agreed with me so far. I'm quite annoyed. Did someone like just say, no, you're wrong about something, and then like, it's okay, I will humour it with good candor. Anyone? No? Okay. Okay, one last one.
I don't disagree with you, but...
why not?
Sorry?
Why not? I'm joking.
I want to ask you about the nature of God.
Sure.
In particular, why does he attribute particular things to himself? So why does he say he's the most forgiving? Why does he say merciful? So why can't be less or more, or all forgiving?
Okay, so why does God attribute to himself that he's merciful and he's forgiving and
yeah,
so
on? Yeah, that's just one example.
Well,
yeah.
This is actually going beyond the realms of kind of this discussion, because today it's just about proof of God's existence. But what I will argue, what I will maybe help you with to kind of set you up in good stead for end of this week, which is kind of, we'll be going to that in more depth, is that basically, I suppose you're asking, if something, it has no limitations to it, how can it have attributes and characteristics of one kind, not another kind, of what have you, right? But here's the thing, the attributes and characteristics of God emanate from will. If God is merciful, it's not because he has an innate nature that makes him merciful, that he's compelled to be merciful against his will. Oh, that is more fundamental than him. That pushes him, becomes an external force that pushes him to be merciful. Because then he wouldn't be the first cause. He wouldn't be the first mover, as Plato would put it, the first initiator. No. If God is merciful, if he describes himself as mercy, that's because he wills out of choice to be merciful. You understand? So it's actually a description of his relationship, his treatment of us, not his innate nature. Because God is above good, evil. These are human concepts related to a created being. A good car is a what? It's a car that can what? What's a good car? You see, the kid gets it. How come you don't get it? He's been showing you up all night. All right. How old are you?
Oh, I'm 11.
Mashallah, he's 11 years old. You know, this was roughly around the same time I was asking the similar questions about things. He's been showing all you up. This is... He should present the next lecture. Anyway, what's a bad car? You've already answered it. Let's give those people who were a chance.
Something that can't transport you.
Something that can't transport you. And why is that? Why does that make a car bad? That's the purpose of the car. So good and bad is only related to your purpose. So God can't be good or bad, but God can be, I actually view it as God can be consistent with his will. So if he basically wills you to do what you call good things, things which are good for you, he also makes you have the same nature that will want, that will that this good things will be complementary for. So he makes you, he gives you the right hardware for your software and the right software for your hardware, right? He gives you the right moral instruction for your innate nature and gives you the right nature for your moral instructions, because he's consistent. If he was inconsistent, that means that God has two wills that conflict each other. You understand? And now we have two gods. Which is why, so God is not beholden, I mean, in the Islamic discussions, obviously, in the Hadith, Qudsi, I believe, a narration of the Prophet Muhammad SAW about what God has said. It is reported that God says he's made injustice forbidden for himself. Meaning that nothing stops him from being unjust, but he chooses to not be unjust. Because if you think about it, that's just him contradicting himself. That'd be contradiction. And of course, that would then, in a way, create two gods. Right? It would be a conflict of wills, but God's will is one and unified. And hence, he'll give you the right teachings that fit your nature, and he'll give you the right nature to fit those teachings, because it's all part of your purpose. And your purpose is only one. Because God gave you, your creator is one. So that's why we know God doesn't have an innate nature. He's just consistent with us. And his mercy is part of that same consistency, which is a theological discussion that we can get into as to mercy and the different schools of thought within Islam that has to. Some would argue that all these attributes are all or actually in a way fundamentally one and the same, because the one comes from the same source and they're one and the same. Some say that it's manifest that you can have plurality of manifestations of the one will, but he makes different things, and he has, you know, with some people he might punish who deserve it, for others who shows mercy who deserve it, and he can do treat different people differently because they are different. But it's really a semantic debate, as in the Islamic philosophers, we don't have a fundamental disagreement. So I'm not part of it, by the way. So those that I have read do not have a fundamental disagreement as to these really key doctrinal points. It's more about what is the right wording to use. Yeah. So some people say when the Quran says that God has a hand or a face, that this is metaphorical. It's metaphorical. And others say it's literal, but bila kayf, as in we don't know what God means by this. It's not like a human hand. It's not a created thing. God doesn't have created things or any attributes about him. When God says he has a hand and face, we just that's not a verse, by the way. They just take one verse which says the hand of God, or everything will be destroyed except the face of God, which the Asharite group will say is metaphorical. They say it's clearly metaphorical, like the Quran will say Ibn Sabil, son of the road, means a traveler. They say that's not literal. If you take it literally, that means that a traveler is literally the sun, his father is a road, right? So there's metaphor can be in the Quran, and the other people say, no, we don't like metaphor. We prefer to say God literally has these things, but we don't know what it means, and we know that we can accept that the verse intends to convey a particular meaning which is in agreement with the Asharites. So hence, they come back full circle to the same position with each other. They just differ on words, basically. For those of you who obviously are want to know a bit more about this kind of stuff. So research Islamic philosophy, but wait until at least Friday for that lecture to go into that. So why Islam in the first place, right? So anyway, well, I think that's about it. If there's any other further points, comments or contention, then thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Jen.